Taonga Pōro, playing Wellington PhD student Ruby Solly, is with us in the studio this morning. Kia ora and welcome.
Kia ora, Catherine.
Ruby is a poet, musician and music therapist. If you didn't catch her, if you didn't catch her post-lockdown released Poneki last year, here's a taste from that album. Oh, it's got to be one of the most beautiful of musical forms and genre, and so peaceful. But that's not where it ends with Ruby. Her first book of poetry, Tōku Papa, is inspired by her father and speaks to Māori growing up outside of their papakaiaka. Her poems embrace knowledge handed down from her ancestors and have been published in journals including Landfall, Starling and Sport. Last year, as we said, she released her debut album, Poneki, which looks at the soundscapes of Wellington's past, present and future through the use of taonga pōro, cello and environmental sounds. She's currently completing a PhD in public health, because she's not busy enough, focusing on the use of taonga pōro in hora Māori. Tēnā koe, Ruby, welcome again.
Tēnā koe, Catherine.
So let's start with the poetry. Tōku Papa, beautiful poetry. Clearly your own papa very much on your mind. Did it begin as individual poems and then you thought, hey, I've got something, you know, more complete here, can be a book?
Yeah, that's kind of how it started out, really. I was doing a paper at the IML, an undergraduate paper in Māori and Pacifica, creative writing with Tina Makariti. And my kind of project I was working on during that time was Tōku Papa, but it was just a shorter version, so it was kind of a 10-poem collection. And then after that, I'd kind of continue writing around that kind of theme and adding to it, and then got a residency to finish the book off, really, with Starling and Lickrell, which is now Verb, back about 2 years ago. Yeah, so it kind of all kind of grew from that initial class, because I was surrounded by so many amazing Māori and Pacifica writers and mentors, and, yeah, it was a great space to explore that.
Tina's a force of nature, isn't she? She's a superstar.
Tina's incredible, yeah.
Yeah. So the writing, did you set out with a theme in mind, or do you start when you become deeply immersed in a time of writing, if I can put it that way, focused time in writing, do the things that really matter or the things that are really deep in the heart come to the surface, and that is what you are writing about?
I think so, yeah. I think it's interesting seeing the different kind of things that people choose to write about when they're in that kind of rakatahi space, that young person space. And a lot of my friends were kind of writing about relationships and things like that. But for me, I was writing more about the things that were deeper and that were going to stay the same for a long time. Like, I knew I was always going to have the same whakapapa and the same dad. So, those were the things that I felt like I needed to sort out in my head, and this was a way of doing that. But it was also a way of kind of modelling what it looks like to sort those things out and what those relationships can look like for other people, I think, especially with things like land and ancestors and things that we don't always have good role models for what working through those relationships can look like, because it can be really messy. It's not always this beautiful thing that we kind of see in movies about people going home. It's often quite complicated. And to show all the aspects of that journey, I think, was really important.
Could you tell us a little more, and feel free to read at any time, of what some of the elements of that journey are?
Yeah, so my dad and I, we both grew up in the North Island, even though our iwi is from Te Waipounamu, Kaitahu, Waitaha and Kāti Māmoe. And so we've always grown up knowing we were Māori and having all these elements of our culture. And, you know, parenting practices, I think, is something that always stays culturally, even if you've lost other parts due to colonisation and other factors. I think a lot about Hall's iceberg models. It's something I really like that shows all of these things underneath the water, underneath the iceberg, underneath the water. Things like parenting practices and the way you see yourself and your relationship with where you are, and these things that we can't see as easily as things like native dress or, you know, housing structures and things that are we can see with our eyes. And yeah, so I think parenting is something that's always there and something that ties us to who we are. So I think for me, knowing I was Māori first was the most important thing, and that's something that my dad always made sure of, and that my family did as well as a whole. But looking kind of at kaitahu identity and realising that was different, and within a Māori identity there's, you know, so many more identities within that, was something that I kind of grasped a bit later, and then kind of looking at why we might have left and what those things look like. Yeah, so all those things are kind of in there ripped up, I think.
What comes through as a great... There's probably not an English word for it. I'd be interested what the Māori word is for it. A great love, but it's deeper than love even. There's this tremendous connection. It's like the umbilical cord is with papa.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's
like
a sense of that.
It's almost like a aho tapu back to your ancestors and atua and things like that. Like there's like a line from you all the way back, and yeah, something that you kind of need to nurture both in the immediate generation and further back and forward, and that's something that, yeah, I think is there. Would you like me to read a thing?
Anytime,
okay. And there's quite a few poems... By quite a few, I mean three, in this book about here and looking kind of at Indigenous views around here. And Makawe is very, very tapu to us. And I grew up having very long plaits. It was actually my mum who wouldn't let me cut my hair for quite a long time, which is I'm grateful for now. But just different memories around those rituals of doing young girls' hair. So this is Makawe to Atoru. They keep asking me when I'm going to cut it. The girls come at me with scissors, the click-click of blades snuck into sleepovers. Here on the pillow in the morning, fine moss on the forest floor. Tiny trims, offcuts gathered up in a jar on the bathroom window, ritualistic preservation, museum pieces behind glass. Papa, we never had a kurawai, but I have grown one. I can wear nothing but myself if I choose to. If my shoulders are back and down, it sits perfectly upon them. Past my feet it grows, strangling me like a vine from the ground up. The birds return to nest in it, weighing me down when they rest, lifting me up when they soar. The birds begin to braid, working in teams of three. I am a mass of ropes pulling in all directions. I can't remember what scissors are, but I remember the sound. I hear the click, click in the wings. The ropes reach and reach, search for snow and salt and the waters where they touch. They will keep growing until they can reach all the way home and pull us back in, my body trailing behind, lifeless in the water.
It's beautiful, Ruby.
Thank you.
You grew up in Whakapapa village.
Yes.
In Mount Ruapehu. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because my first thought, that is your maunga, but you're talking about kaitahu.
Yeah,
and this is
an Aoraki girl. Yeah,
this is part of the...
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, but I think where we grew up, we had really strong relationships with mana whenua because we worked at DOC. And, yeah, I don't know, I'm saying we. I was three, I wasn't doing a hell of a lot. But... But yeah, so we always felt like, you know, you feel like you're under a kurawai aroha of you know, people wherever you are if you're having that relationship. So I have a really strong relationship with Whakapapa as a place and memories there, and with Te Whareto as well, and Taupō and Turangi where I lived after that. And yeah, and we always had a really strong relationship with the outdoors in terms of connecting, and yeah, which is really special.
It's interesting because it seems like it has always been a precious taonga, your knowledge of this, and it's been from birth, it's been part of your life. And we sometimes hear from Māori for whom there is an isolation, and then at some point in life they begin their journey. But for you it seems to have always been.
Yeah, that's a really interesting kind of thing. I think part of that is that where we lived was always a community, and there was always like a connection and a systemic way of looking where everyone is connected to everybody else. And to do that, you kind of have to really know who you are and why you're there, or people are going to see a sense of falseness, and, you know, it's going to be a lot more apparent than if you were to do something like that in a city. So I think that because of that kind of upbringing, that's why it's always been that way, perhaps. But I've had people, several people now talk to me after the launch of the book and say, for them, that was their moment that they realised that, oh man, I haven't looked into this, mm-hmm. and this is something that I want in my life, and talk to me about it.
Was there a point when you definitely went deeper and immersed yourself, or it just became to the fore of your life in some ways? Like, was there an age or a time or a place where you really deliberately went deeper?
Yeah. In terms of, like, Te Ao Māori, or in yeah. terms of writing, yeah. in terms of Te Ao Māori. I think I've always felt just as Māori as I am, but I think that when I started playing tangapuoro, kind of more seriously, I guess, when I was at university, that was a time that it wasn't so much that I was going deeper at that point, it was just that I think more people kind of saw me as Māori at that point in time. And that had interesting elements to it as well. But yeah, I think at that point in time, things started to connect up. And for me, tangapuoro was a skill that I could take back to kind of communities I was from and say, this is another way that I speak.
That's interesting. So there's a difference between your own self and then others' perception. And does that affect people particularly? You know, I hear in you a rock-solid identity and knowledge of who you are, but then you have others' perceptions of who you are. And have you been aware of that?
Yeah. I love talking about race. No, I really don't. But... yeah, I think I've always been aware of that. And I think certain places it feels quite apparent. Yeah, and it can be quite interesting if you are in more academic spaces, or if you're in more, even writing spaces. Like, there is a real feeling that if you are other in any way, you are definitely other. There's a real definite sense of othering. And I think people want to figure out what that is. I think it's an interesting space to live in, but it doesn't really matter to me because I've got a really strong identity in who I am, and I think all the people around me are like that as well, or they're in a place where they want to be feeling like that, which is why they're there.
Dare I bring up the education system, because I think I recall from reading something else you've written or said, were there moments there where it was just stark, you know?
Yeah, I've had a few weird moments in the education system. I remember I had a petty moment the other day, but I didn't follow up on. But I had an English teacher who said to me once that she was surprised I was Māori because I was so good at English, which is surprising. But there's Māori and English in my book, so that's cool.
You see, I'm hearing a strong wahine, strong in herself, strong in every way, strong in her identity here, and I could just see how that could demolish someone less secure.
Yeah, and I think those things do, there is a part of me where those things are behind a door and they just kind of stay there, and occasionally someone opens it and they all fall out.
Yeah.
But I put them back.
The tangapuoro, did I hear the cello was your first instrument?
Yeah, in a way. So I, at my primary school, National Park Primary School, we had a teacher, Maria Kappa, who taught us how to play kōwowo and purerehua. So I could get a few notes out of kōwowo when I was really little, like 5 or 6, and run just around doing that.
Explain the instruments a little more for those of us less knowledgeable.
So kōwowo it belongs to Hinero Katauri, the Atua flute music, and is kind of like a open-ended tube with either some holes in it to use as to change the kind of pitch in a way, or without. And it's like a side-blown flute. Yeah, so I could do that, and then I learnt guitar at primary school as well, but, you know, very basic level when I was kind of 5 to 7, and then I learnt cello from when I was 7 when we moved to Taupo, because I'd always wanted to do it and it was a big enough place.
Kids always want big instruments, don't they? I think I wanted a... what do I want? I want a saxophone.
Oh, that wouldn't come.
I got a little plastic one on my Christmas page. But kids always seem to go for big instruments, don't they?
Yeah, I don't. It was quite. It's quite inconvenient. Like, I do love the sound of the cello, but I definitely have days where I'm like, why did you choose this? You could have chosen something else.
Yeah. But was it the sound that drew you to it?
Yeah, I saw Yo-Yo Ma playing on Sesame Street, and I was like, when you know, when kids just get obsessed about something, like, that's my thing now. Yeah. I'd had a that's my thing now moment. Yeah. And, yeah, but then it's got the same resonance as a human voice. Mm. It's, there's so many different genres that cello can fit in for me. And, yeah, it's a perfect instrument for me. I do still love it just but as much as
also
then.
Also, if we're thinking about that sound that many of us associate with Taungapōro, it's on the same level again, like it fits again, because often it's a beautiful, resonant, you know, emotional sound that I associate with that instrumentation anyway, as well as the natural sounds accompanying it. So it seems like, I mean, it was an electric guitar, it wouldn't fit quite so well.
It'd be cool.
So what was the music? So you had the sort of a traditional musical education and a love, and wonderful to have a teacher who introduced you so early to the instruments. But then what was the path beyond that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one too, looking now at where we are in terms of revival. So I didn't have access to Taungapōro or anyone who played for quite a long time after that. So when I went to a school in the bigger town, that wasn't part of what was happening there. So I didn't really play again. Occasionally I'd, you know, pick up something that I could do some found sounds on and show off at a party, to be honest, but that would be about it. And then at uni, Al Fraser taught me how to play, and Ariana T. Kyle mentors me as well. So those two, and Haniwe Dangi, Kohu Morgan. But I'm kind of part of the Taungapōro players here, and yeah, everyone has shown me different things, and I've probably shown other people some things as well. It's a really great community to be in.
Is it an expertise that one never masters? Well, one or two have, but only one or two. And is it also a form of music that allows a tremendous amount of scope, I guess, and inventiveness?
Completely. There's a lot of responsibility, I think, in it as well. Like, it's something that will give a lot to you, but you have to give a lot back to it. Yeah, I think there's kind of a certain amount of techniques that you learn, but then from there you can kind of experiment a lot. And yeah, it involves all kind of different aspects of your life, really, I think, for Māori. Like, for me it involves spirituality and connection with land and connection with whānau. Like, there's a whole lot of things going on when you're playing. And there's lots of different styles you can play. Like, you can definitely play along with kind of Western music, but you can also be playing in a way that you're just playing for the immediate space that you're in an environment and doing a mihi to that space or what you think is needed.
When you say you have to give a lot back, is it hard work? It's a skill.
I don't know. Hard's probably not the right word. It's kind of more like deep work, I think.
Deep, all right.
Yeah, it's like there's a depth to it. But it's like anything, the more you put into it, the more you're going to get back from it. And, yeah, I'm really lucky that I get to work as a researcher around Taungapōro, and I get to teach at Wānanga and do lots of things. It's great.
How much has it grown? I'm thinking of the great Hirini Melbourne, of course, who is just the giant. And how much in the last decade or two even has it grown as an opportunity for many musicians?
I think it's grown really rapidly in the last kind of decade. And, you know, I'm included within that, I guess. But I think the more it grows, the more we kind of look at how we need to stay safe and how we protect people who are using these instruments. And, yeah, there's a lot to be done, but we're all out there doing it, which is really positive, and everyone's really close. And, yeah, it's
stay
a special
safe
community.
Being there's a lot of demand.
Yeah.
Or is that what you mean, or is it more allowing the spirituality of the playing to, you know, to not be exploited, so to speak, or to become to become a burden?
Like, having an understanding of tikanga and people knowing where they come in terms of the whakapapa of the movement. And yeah, but I think that the taonga themselves often can convey that themselves. You know, when people see something that's really precious and that has that whakapapa to it, they often know how to treat it, or just the modelling of how everyone else is treating it, they'll know what what to do. And I think that, yeah, we have a lot of those things built into how we educate and how we pass on knowledges around modelling.
Let's read again. Do you have one in mind?
I sure do.
Thank you.
All right. This is a nice one. This is one about the Tauranga Taupō River, which was right next to our house, one of our houses. And it's about, we'd have all these kids would come down from the cities and stay in all these batches, and they'd have all of these water toys, just must have got water toys for Christmas every year, and kayaks and things. And we had a few, but we weren't really the water toys type. And my dad would put all these kids, other kids' water toys on the back of this trailer and drive up the river and drop us all off, and we'd go down the river on all these water toys. But I didn't have a water toy and I had to swim. So this is about that. This is River Songs, Tauranga Taupō. You want me to be a strong swimmer, because girls who can swim can always get themselves out of trouble. The other kids around here get little boats for Christmas. They take them down the river, launch them from the mudflats, push and pull new oars until they are only distant toys to those on the shore. But not me. You take us all up the river, drop us into the current, the others in their little boats or straddling old tyres. But not me. I need to learn how to swim. Through rapids we go, my legs weaving through debris. When I was small, you took me in your arms and walked me out into the water for the first time. I watched my mother on the shore getting smaller and smaller, but I never cried or screamed, only opened my eyes wider and wider as she changed from person to shape to colour, as the water darkened around your waist. When I am thrashing through rapids, sticks and stones cut me a map of red rivers as the boats lag behind me, their hulls rippling the blood in my wake. I always escape the mouth before they arrive. Each time, there you are, calling to all the fishermen, that they don't need to worry about me. She's a girl who can go with the current. She's a girl who can swim.
Well, wise papa, again,
I think
there's fewer greater gifts. We give our children a real strength in swimming and confidence in water.
It has come in very handy.
It helps on the adventure front and getting out of it. Ruby Solly's our guest, poet, musician and music therapist. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. So these are what we're discussing, the first book of poetry, Tōku Papa, just out. But tell me about Pōneke, the album, and the sort of forces that shaped that.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out how long I spent working on it. I was trying to do this for book the other day too. I think I spent about 2 years working on Pōneke. So it was around my practice of learning Tongapuro and wanting to learn from the environments, because you kind of learn from playing with others, from listening to recordings, but mostly you learn from being in environments and mimicking those, I think. So it was going into different places in Wellington and recording that process and then layering it up with cello at home to make sure that the environment kind of had the main kind of role in the
stage.
Recording. Mm. Yeah, the main stage, and then everything else supported that. And through that process, I also did a bit of kind of whakapapa research and kind of historical research around different places. Sometimes the research coming first and sometimes it coming second, which was really interesting, where you could hear things that really echoed the stories. Yeah, so it follows a lot of Kati Mamoe, kind of old trails and things within Wellington before they moved down south. And it also looks at a lot of colonial history as well, and the kind of parts they touch. Yeah.
The music therapy side of things as well, does this come together with the PhD you're doing in your spare time?
Kind of, yeah.
What's been the story with the therapy and now the research you're doing into the, you know, the health benefits, the overall health benefits of music? Start with the therapy.
Yeah, so I did a master's in music therapy looking at the use of tangapuro on acute mental health, which was really amazing work to be doing at that time. It was a few years ago now, and yeah, I had some really great results and really amazing seeing people getting so much out of our taonga and being able to give some taonga back to people who are at points in their lives where not a lot of taonga were being given to them, kind of in a metaphorical sense, you know, like they were not being given things from the world that they really should have been. And yeah, that was really special work. And after completing that, there was kind of a lot of interest in more work like that being done. And yeah, so I decided that I wanted to be the one to do it, because otherwise it would have been other people, and I wanted it to be me.
So it's a big journey, a PhD. We've talked about many journeys, but it's a big one. And where are you at in shaping what you want this to be, and ultimately the gift, the taonga you want to give to the world from it, I guess?
Yeah.
How's it shaping?
Well, I think the big kind of realisation, I guess, well, not really realisation, but of something that's solidified itself more within my thinking, is that it's not really mine to give. It comes from all the people in that community, and it's really important that research comes from the communities themselves, I think. And yeah, I've been really lucky. I've been interviewing a whole bunch of really amazing practitioners and players who work using taonga pūroro in health in Hauora Māori, and kind of finding all of these really similar themes and across everybody's work. So that's where I'm at the moment, just kind of putting that together.
What sorts of themes are common?
This feels like a confirmation. This is funny. yeah, a lot of people talking about the taonga themselves being the healer is not really the right word here. It doesn't do what we need it to do. But the taonga themselves kind of being the catalyst for wellness here, or the catalyst for kind of health or hauora. And people kind of talking about the kind of all the things that those taonga represent, and that comes through them. And a lot of symbolism, I think, is a lot of metaphor within our work as Māori, and that comes through in the way we practice therapy and our ceremonies and in our writing as well. Like, it's no wonder that we have so many amazing Māori poets, because everything we do is metaphorical. And yeah, like someone who can't speak, that'll be like, of course we'll give you an instrument that will help you to do that. And then that becomes their voice, you know, it's a living poem, really. Yeah, so a lot of pieces like that.
It's exciting. I know there's a lot of work ahead, but it's really exciting. Can I get one more poem out of you?
You sure can.
Thank you, Ruby.
You sure can. I like this one because it's got a kaitahu motiatia in it, which is about the kumara harvest and digging. But I've used it here about a time where Dad was working as a grave digger. And I have memories as a kid of going with my dad to dig graves and always being really naughty and playing on the dirt and getting in trouble and being sent off on a bunch of fool's errands to get out of everyone's way. This is called 6 feet for a single, 8 feet for a double. My father leaves school to dig graves. The first break is the hardest. The pressure of foot on steel, the smell of earth rising. Koia, koia, e taue koia. The men sit with packed lunches, talking about the weather next to holes they have dug themselves. When he leaves the job, he keeps his shovel. Always comes home to dig for the whānau. Koia, koia, e taue koia. He keeps me playing graveside, tells me off for climbing the pile of earth, sends me to find things, the grave with the lamb, the grave with the clasped hands. He says this is how the dead speak, a lamb for a child, clasped hands pulling each other up to heaven. But this is not the only way. The atmosphere traps us in our bodies, holds our teeth and tongues in place. My father says he has no rhythm, but when he digs, you see it in his body. The flow through the earth into the feet, contracting the calves, through the spine to chiseled arms, through aging hands into the shovel, and back into the whenua. Koia, koia, e taue koia. With each beat, he piles up dirt higher and higher, making a lofty mountain for us to bow to.
Kia ora, Ruby. And Papa. The book is Tōku Papa, Ruby Solly's first book of poetry. Ngā mihi. And ka kite. Hope to see you again.
Thank you for having me.